I would like to introduce now Julian Stalabres. And in comparison to the speakers that have been here now this afternoon before you, you're an outsider of this specific media art discourse that is happening, for example, in venues like Ars Electronica since 10 years and where most people are forming a kind of community. So what for Gunther and me was very interesting that you come from a different field of cultural and political theory and have reached a certain fame by criticizing, for example, the young British art in your book, Art and Money. And, no, sorry, it was a wrong title. It was a show, you know, that you wrote a book, a critical book about young British art and continued to curate a show, Art and Money Online, at the Tate Britain. That was happening in 2001, and the resume of that show was published as a book, one of the rare books which deals with net art only, to be published recently, titled The Online Clash of Culture and Commerce. So for us it was very interesting of somebody entering and re-entering the field of net art from a theoretical, political perspective at the moment of decline, because that is what we think, that the story isn't told yet and it is not over. It's just starting to re-emerge and to be re-evaluated what the real importance of what has been happening in the 90s could be. So thank you very much for being here and looking forward to what you will present to us. Yeah.
Thank you so much for that introduction and for the invite to be here. I'm extremely glad to be here. I was working with Tate on the show and on the book Internet Art, and there was a 2-year delay in the publication of that book, so it was already fantastically historical by the time it appeared. And I was also fascinated by what Verena was saying about net art archaeology, and it reminded me that there are other areas of modern and contemporary art where that may be true, and perhaps Soviet avant-garde art is another way of approaching a kind of archaeology, because so much of that work was suppressed and disappeared, and so much of what has been recovered is, you know, perhaps dubious and faked and so on. Anyway, I'd like to begin by showing you something which, just to go back to Ted Nelson's point, may or may not be art. I'm not really sure. At first sight, in the relationship between art history and internet art, if we want to call it that, it's the antagonisms that stand out. And they were summarized for me a few years back when a colleague asked me what I was working on, and I said, well, internet art. And she replied with one single word or sound, yuck. I don't know if that translates well into German. Yet, the subject we're more closely examined has a surprising slipperiness and complexity to it, in part because both art history and internet art have been changing rapidly, although the former a good deal more quickly than the latter, and also that some internet art, even things which make a very serious point, this piece by, do we call it a piece? I'm not sure whether it's an artwork exactly. It's by a guy called Tim Oblique, which I guess is a pen name of some sort, and it's Iraq War Coalition Fatalities. So some internet art or some internet culture looks a good deal prettier than it once did, and certainly the stern avant-gardist dual of aesthetic characteristics of early net art, often proffered tongue-in-cheek, of course, are no longer held to. Art history, as we shall say, has also undergone a rapid colonization, such that many of its core foundational precepts are open to question, or at least apparently. Direct engagements between the two remain fairly rare. Most of the writers on internet art have different backgrounds in film studies, media studies, visual culture, or most often as practitioners, organizers, and curators of the art itself. I know I'm an exception, since I have a job teaching art history. That's one of the reasons I've been invited here, I guess. But I'm not so sure that even I'm an art historian. Even so, art history remains important to any internet culture that wants to call itself art, and that designation has an enduring attraction for art history, along with its antagonistic companion, art criticism, is a gatekeeper to the gallery and museum world. And also, for an online cultural worker, the use of art history, including references to avant-gardism or conceptualism, is the swiftest and surest way to get what you're doing called art. So that the engagements between online art and art history are rare shouldn't be a cause of surprise. Think of art history's ghettoization and neglect of other new media, notably photography and video. The literature of photography remains separate from art history. Photography's early theorists were photographers themselves, or poets, philosophers, and cultural theorists. Think of Baudelaire, Benjamin, Krakauer, Giselle Freyond, Stieglitz, and so on. And right up to the present, some of the most significant writing about photography has been penned by practitioners, and certainly not by art historians. Think of Sekula, Martha Rossler, Bergin, Jeff Waugh, and so on. And it was only when the art market boom for photography began in the 1970s that scene began to change. And along with it, there was a sort of sympathetic postmodern turn in art theory itself. Likewise, the art historical writing on video had to wait for that art to be drawn into the museum in the 1990s through the medium of video projection. The recent apotheosis of photography in the art museum offers, I think, a warning to net art. I'm just going to move to PowerPoint presentation. For example, Andreas Gursky's major show at the MoMA in 2001, or Thomas Struth's show at the Metropolitan Museum in 2003, certainly got away from that ghettoization of this large-scale, spectacular museum photography. But at the cost of suppressing the history of photography, the comparison's being made more often with the grand tradition of painting. It was as if photography could only be validated on such a scale with doubtful associations with the sanctified tradition of Western art. I remember going to the Struth show at the Metropolitan, and there were two huge banners hanging from the front of the gallery. One read Leonardo da Vinci, the other one Thomas Struth, which must have done something for his ego, I imagine. So in this present practice, the peculiar, mannered, and fetishized museum print with all its large format stateliness and deportment becomes the end point of a history designed to bring it about, a partial history in which, say, photographic documentary practice, for instance, is despised and written out. Nevertheless, a striking thing about the literature on internet art, even when it's not written by art historians, is that it draws on some of the standard devices of art history. And one of these is the construction of traditions, of historical lines. I was going to make a number of these, but I didn't have time in the end. But so I'm in no way kind of picking on Rachel Green here, and this is a book I admire in lots of ways, her book on internet art, published in 2004. But what I've done here is to just draw out these two lines from that book in the way that she presents them. So, and as I say, this is a sort of symptomatic thing to do. You could probably do it from my book, too. In these cases, two parallel lines are made, one technological and one art historical, and the two don't meet or interact, and the claims being made for the relations between the phenomena in each of the lines are quite different. In the technological line, it's generally a causal issue. Without this invention or idea, the following step could not have taken place. In the art historical line, it's much less clear. Is it an issue of unconscious or semi-conscious influence, conscious use or retooling on the part of artists, the innocent reinvention of some prior idea, or a vaguer idea of some form of zeitgeist? The lists generally don't say. And I guess this is a question I'd have for people who want to see male art, for instance, as a precursor to net art. What exactly are we saying in terms of that? Are we merely doing some rather perhaps suspicious and conventional art historical task of remaking a tradition in light of the present? another fundamental issue, and one I struggle with in my book, is what is the object of art? Is it singular? Is there really something that connects Paleolithic cave painting, a Cezanne landscape, and a shopping trip or shopping trolley by Sylvie Fleury? The problem is, of course, particularly acute with internet art, where the usual institutional assurances for the viewing of art are very often absent. And it's led some critics to hang on to, as we've heard today, ideas of autonomy and medium specificity. Tilman Baumgartel, for instance, does so in his introduction to Net Art 2.0, even citing Greenberg, trying to definitively fix the art status of internet art in that way. It's a hard tactic to maintain because the net is not a medium as painting is. We've heard some of this from Lev Manovich, of course. Baumgartel eventually, after some ironically tinged avant-garde pronouncements on net purity and so on, gives up the game. He says, net art's material, he says, is utterly anything having to do with the internet. Well, this is a strange medium, right? The issue is quite similar to that of photographic autonomy. Concentrations on the medium's essential characteristics lead not to flatness and abstraction, as with painting, but to a more accurate depiction of the world. And I think you could say something quite similar about net art and its engagements with the social. This is a Walker Evans, for those of you who don't know. Tied up with the word art is often the idea, rarely made explicit these days, and indeed sometimes disavowed within art history, that it describes not merely an institutional category or even a particular kind of human activity, but that it also carries with it a judgment about quality. Ernst Gombrich, for instance, logically defended this position explicitly, that art history was not the same as cultural history, or it wasn't by any means a subset of sociology, and that a small, defined canon of works of high quality constituted its corpus and its very reason for being, and its particular contribution to the humanities, too. And we're very familiar, I'm sure, with the paradoxical results of this, that toys and figurines from the ancient world inhabit museums and form part of the corpus of art history, but not so their contemporary equivalents. I've been running a little photographic project of my own called Actually Existing Sculpture, which is sort of documenting the vulgar afterlife of sculpture after its demolition by the contemporary art world, if you like. Whole categories of visual cultural production never gain art historical attention. Amateur photography would be an example, along with, of course, a swathe of online practices. Naturally, the vast majority of the work in this festival would not qualify for the canon either. Tied to that idea of art and quality are a couple of connected art historical assumptions, linked in tension, if not in outright contradiction. And they are that the true meaning of a work of art can be translated into language, into discourse in some way, but also that the true meaning of the work of art is untranslatable. Donald Preziosi put his sort of finger on that in a book of his about art history. So art's Kunstwollen, this phrase by a word by Reigel, or structure, Sedlmayr and the Vienna School idea of an aesthetic impulse in culture that's irreducible, unexplainable, recalcitrant in some way. And naturally, in this situation, art history must be similarly opaque and generally dependent on allegory and metaphorical language to arrive at its expressions. So the particularity and autonomy of the work of art is pitched against the history of style as a narrative or causal chain, and the relationship between those two is very murky in much of art history. The art object then is secure in its status and in its truly mysterious in its being, and equally art history, its strange an inexplicable translation into language is artful itself, an exercise of aesthetic intuition and an aesthetic performance as much as an academic discipline. Now, of course, what I've been laying out for you here is in some ways a parody or a caricature of the discipline of art history. There's lots of it, which is not anything like that. It's, after all, a subject that has been thoroughly colonized by the practices of diverse parts of high theory, and at the expense of its founding figures. James Elkins, in his art seminar series of books, has this very interesting chart, which is drawn from the Art Index data. And it shows, well, first the rise of various kinds of theory in art history, just in terms of citations, but also, very tellingly, the rise and fall of many of its key figures in terms of their own citations, including Panofsky, Gombrich, Shapiro, and so on. And Thomas Crowe has complained about this very matter in his book, The Intelligence of Art, where he says that, well, it's all very well for art history to open itself up to all these associated disciplines, but that there doesn't seem to be any reciprocity here. There's nothing that art history itself offers to these disciplines as well as takes things from them. And, of course, the discipline is highly various. If you look at the work of my colleague Peter Stewart on Roman art, for example, that draws on the work of the anthropologist Alfred Gell, you'll find an account of the relationship between viewer and art that's quite alien to contemporary views and has little to do with any of the assumptions that I talked about above. Nevertheless, this parody or caricature, this parodic view, is persistent and widespread, and it may be argued that the kind of theory adopted with most success in art history is that which supports the view of the work of art and its creators as both ineffable objects of the highest impermeability to reason and of profound mystery. Deleuze's Bergsonian vitalism is an obvious example here, as are various kind of metaphorical keys into the zeitgeist in some Foucaultian accounts, for example. And if that parodic view retains its barb, it's surely because of art history's necessarily close connection with the museum and the commercial gallery world, and their connection with the increasingly privatized academy, always on the hunt for new business partners of one kind or another. So both museums and galleries are committed to the mystification of the objects that they display, holding to the fiction of a distinct realm of high art that stands above the bureaucratized world of work and the complementary vulgar blandishments of mass culture. Now, internet art, as we've heard, is not a great field for the pursuit of exercises like that. And Verinder has touched on many reasons for that. I'll go through a few quickly. First, after the flash of the dot-com boom, when for a short time, obviously, museums were very interested in it, internet art has become generally disconnected from the museum and the market for art. Second, its post-medium condition doesn't lend itself to any plausible account of autonomy, as we've seen, despite such works as this, kind of foundational works. And thus, the new cultural form has no secure claim to the status of art. And its post-medium condition is even more invidious than that of installation art, which is at least connected to the museum, although installation art, too, has had a rough ride from certain members of the October group, for example, precisely on the grounds that it lacks a medium, and that without a medium, well, how can you have art history? Third, internet art's connections with history, and especially technology, seem too immediate and transparent. This undercuts the mystery, the quality of the object. It remains too close for many conventional art viewers to elements of mass culture. And fourth, the repudiation of high theory by many of its internet arts practitioners and writers challenges the heavy investment that many art historians have made in such practices, and which they're reluctant to abandon, even in the face of overwhelming evidence. There are continuing attachment to psychoanalysis being a kind of obvious example there. Now, despite all this, art history and the institutions that surround and support it may yet claim internet art in a more thoroughgoing and consistent fashion. And as I say, we glimpse that possibility at the moment of the dot-com boom. After all, it has begun to do so with video, about which many of the same things could be said 15 or 20 years ago, though at the price of a profound transformation of that art. Art history may be seen as a great rhetorical apparatus tied to the contemporary art market, and for the time being booming with it, as Lev pointed out, in a massive expansion of studies of the contemporary. For instance, now in the US in particular, There's a huge dominance of, if you look at the doctoral students going through in art history programs, there's a huge dominance of post-war art history as against everything else. And some fields are virtually, like the 18th century, are virtually disappearing. In a sense, then, one hopes that art history remains a minor part of the writing about internet art, and that the term art continues to be viewed with suspicion by internet art, cultural practitioners. Without it, connections may be established to a far broader range of cultural influence and influences and causes than those outlined in the art historical tradition, and which often take the form of a kind of veiled market sanction. But I want to flip the question over and ask what internet art and digital culture broadly may bring to art history. After all, photography, long repudiated as a subject for art history, was art history's very basis as an academic subject, first in the black and white print and then in the colour slide. And perhaps those two aspects are linked, in fact, for how can a tool also be thought of as an art? I was actually the first person to run a course in the Courtauld Institute on the history of photography. I found out when I started to do this that the library had a policy, of a written policy, of never collecting photography books because these were not considered art. So anyway, Britain's very backward in these regards, as you should know. Digital resources obviously open up access to vast archival and visual resources to many more people, and this is bound to have a leveling effect, not only on research, but also curation, as has already been happening. Aside from the sway of the market and the museum, two major difficulties have left art history at a level of primitive level of analysis, dependent on the sensibilities and intuitions of its writers. The first is that there has been no agreed way of describing visual phenomena, not even paintings or drawings. And this is beginning to change with a digital reverse engineering of human picture recognition mechanisms, producing testable and systematic descriptions, which may be tied to historical accounts. The second is that there's been little work done on the character of viewer interactions with art objects, and little interest in gathering them, given the great mismatch between the viewers and owners of art. The gap between sociology and art history can clearly be glimpsed here by looking at the work of pioneering work of Pierre Bourdieu, for example. Online, though, the scanning and measuring of viewers is a fairly is pretty much a standard and begins to offer, along with developments in the brain sciences, the feedback mechanisms the study of art needs to found itself as a more objective discipline, one that can truly identify correlations and work towards the settling of questions rather than the endless proliferation of discourse, and also towards the demonstration of causal effects. Just wanted to show quickly here. Take a moment to load. This is actually a work that Liv has written something about called The Dumpster. Is it going to happen? It'll start to work in a minute, I hope. But it's a work which feeds off sociological data, in essence, and so which is why I wanted to show it as an example of. Finishing it. Seem to want to move. In this, there's an opportunity for a much more thorough demystification of the process of making and viewing art than that envisaged even in the salutary writings of Lovink, Garcia, Fuller, etc., these new skeptical critics of net.art. And with it, a clearing of the fog around the very term art itself. It offers art history the prospect of a much deeper transformation than that affected even by photography. Whether either internet art or art history will survive such a development is an open question, I think. Thank you.
Well, before the break, just a few questions. In my case, I don't have very much, but maybe this links very much to our question somehow, how the net will change art history, and not how art history is incapable of looking at the net, but to inverse this question is very sympathetic to our way of thinking. And it even links back to Walter Benjamin, that you don't have to ask how if photography can be an art, but how photography changed the notion of art. So that is an ongoing question. So you have been so busy many times there. Kann jemand das Mikrofon an die Dame mit der Brille geben? Da? Yeah.
That, you know, the net is probably the world's first truly global practice, and that in terms of art historical, in terms of what's happening with net art history, there's still this systematic exclusion of anything from the Southern Hemisphere or of artists from Asia. I haven't seen one example this morning, today, of any artists being spoken about from outside Europe or the United States, which for those of us that come from those regions is sort of rather disturbing, as we see ourselves written out of history constantly. There's, you know, for example, do you know that the Australian National Gallery has a net art gallery, but it's in the education section, not the curatorial section. There's a major... there was a major survey of net art in 2004, which I curated. There's a book called At a Distance, written by Norrie Neumark and Anne-Marie Chandler, which is a fantastic reference book for anyone who's looking at the precursors to net art. It covers all those practices of Fluxus, sound art, radio art, telematic art, etc., etc. Yeah, so more of a comment, really.
Okay, next one.
Thanks a lot for your presentation. And my question would be about this thing. We were talking about galleries and these cultural spaces that represent, actually, they legitimize art, right? So how do you consider this growing pressure of, it's in some sense promoted by corporate world, say Apple computers, they really heavily promote this amateur creative activity in music, in photograph, in whatever. And there, I think the whole phenomenon, say, of YouTube, right, is based on these multiple individual creative activities, which are what? And seems like now it's been becoming at least a context for the art history. It's not enough to go online and check Ars Electronica Web Archive to figure who's the biggest name in the field, right? There is a bigger context. YouTube, Wikipedia, Grapherman type of, you know, literature. So what do you think, how these external, creative, multiple activities can be analyzed, conceptualized, and at least, you know, mentioned in art history? Thank you.
Part of what I was meaning to suggest was that art history is constitutionally incapable of handling those kinds of references. That may be harsh, but that you would have to imagine a pretty fantastic reformation of the discipline in order for it to begin to do that, and that. I guess that one would hope that art history, although it certainly has some kind of a role to play, after all, in describing and analyzing a phenomenon in which art seems to be a very attractive model for some cultural practitioners online still, and art history still seems to be a highly sort of relevant reference for them, but. I mean, I absolutely accept what you're saying, and in terms of those, you know, that wider cultural production, I'm not sure how much it has to offer. It's also a question of whether high art generally has an extremely has a sort of structurally oppositional relationship to mass culture, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily true of a lot of internet art. So that seems to be a huge difference. But I mean, what your question raises also is the idea of this amazing plenitude of amateur, production, and this—it seems to me the kind of YouTube effect leaks out into the physical world too. And there are two really striking examples of the art world being affected by things it's normally indifferent to, which is a sort of a popular approbation. In the prices of both Banksy, the graffiti artist, and Jack Vetriano, who is a popular Scottish painter whose works in reproduction sell more than anybody else's. But what's been interesting is that the art world doesn't want to have a lot to do with these people generally, but that their prices, nevertheless, in the auction market and so on, are beginning to creep up. And normally those things are disconnected. And maybe these are just, isolated phenomenon, but it'd be extremely interesting to see whether that kind of idea of, a sort of popular feedback effect taking place within the art world, is sustained in any way.